Human Services will come to order. The secretary, please take the roll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vice Chair Sheldon Galloway.
Here.
Vice Chair Buckley.
Here.
Representative Regeer.
Excused.
Representative Etchart.
Excused.
Representative Hawk.
Excused.
Representative Hinkle.
Here.
Representative Nikolakakos.
Here.
Representative Marshall.
Here.
Representative Smith.
Excused.
Representative Welch.
Here.
Representative Staffman.
Here.
Representative Abbott.
Here.
Representative Zephyr.
Here.
Representative Frazier.
Excused.
Representative Howell.
Here.
Representative Yakowicz.
Excused.
Representative Nickel.
Here.
Representative Rusk.
Here.
Representative Oblander.
Here.
Representative Buttry.
Here.
Chair Carlson.
Here. And let the record reflect that Representative Smith is also present online.
That is all, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Members, we have three bills today. This microphone is sounding off. Am I very loud?
We can hear you.
Okay. House Bill 582. I know I saw the sponsor here, so 509. Oh, there you are. And 513. So we will go ahead and open the hearing on House Bill 582. Representative, please open on your bill.
Testing. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the Committee of Human Services, for the record, my name is Jonathan Windyboy, representing House District 32 from Box Elder to Hinsdale on the south side of Highway 2. And this bill here that I'm bringing forth is a simple bill, and I'll give you a little bit of history of how this came about. Back in 2019, there were some of you that weren't here, and this CHAP bill is called the Community Health Aid Program Bill. And once this bill was introduced, there was a federal law that was passed way back in 1972 when then President Nixon signed it into law with the Indian Self-Determination Act. And for all these years, there hasn't really been anything done in this arena. Excuse me. But the Community Health Aid Program Bill has different elements to it. And one is called the DHAT, the MHAT, and the BHAT, which it means dental health aid technician, mental health aid technician, and the behavioral health aid technician. What this basically does, giving you an example of what the dental health aid does, is of all the kiddos that are in school, the students that are in school in a public school system, the dental health aid, after being licensed and trained and all of that, we'll go into the schools and take a look at the kiddos' teeth, for example, and if they see anything major, then they'll raise the red flag and say this one needs specialized care. And so, given my tribe for an example, the dentist that we use on specialty care on some of the dental needs for children in my schools is that we have a form of we have travel and everything that will transport them to Helena, which is the specialty dentist that we use for my tribe. And no doubt there's probably other tribes that do that, but that's just an example. And what this bill does, once the licensure and all of the trainings are set up, and there has been things have, as far as training these on the local tribal colleges to bring these dental health aid technicians, mental health and behavioral health aid, to identify the needs and then get them into the specialty care that they are. And what's good about this bill is that once the local health officials identify these specialty needs, kids that need the specialty care into these specialized either dentist, mental health, or behavioral health, then there's also an opportunity for third-party revenue generating for the local health facilities. And when we had this up for hearing, it was brought to my attention that there can be a possibility of generating up to $3 to $4 million in revenue generating to enhance the local health care needs of the overall health facilities on a local level. So this is something that we have done. When we presented this, it was a kind of heavy duty carry, because we had all kinds of opposition on this thing, which one was from all the dentists in that industry. But the thing is that the opposition's argument was that they didn't want any untrained people to come in and do. It was never the case. We just need to get the red flag up and then get them to the specialty dentist for the kids to get their specialized care. So in reality, at the end of the day, this would be a win-win situation for everybody. And how it would be a win-win situation is because once we get to the kiddos down to the specialty dentists down here, for example, they'll also get that third party, whether it be Medicaid or whatever. And so, like I said, the needs are great in Indian Country. So that's what this bill does, and everything that we've said what we're going to do. And then House Bill 599 in 2019, we've done here on the local level. And the only reason why I'm bringing this to you now is because, as you can see on page 1, line 11, where it says the termination will be September 30, 2023, and I'm asking for an extension of the sunset to September 30, 2025, because right now the holdup are the feds. We all kind of know how that situation goes. But anyways, the feds need to take the lead on this particular piece of legislation to set up this licensure thing and everything. So in reality, we've done what we needed to do here. So I'll stand for questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. We can hear from proponents in the room, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Stacey Anderson, A-N-D-E-R-S-O-N, here on behalf of the Montana Primary Care Association. I think many of you recall that we represent the 5 urban Indian organizations in the state of Montana. They're located in Billings, Butte, Great Falls, Helena, and Missoula. And we rise in support of House Bill 582. We've supported the community health aid program being developed in the state of Montana in 2019, and we think extending the sunset and getting the program all the way through the federal process and actually being able to implement in the state of Montana would be great, not only for the tribes and building their workforce, but also our tribal health partners. So we urge you to do pass. Thank you.
Thank you. Further proponents in the room? If you're a proponent online, please raise your hand.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brad Longcake, L-O-N-G-C-A-K-E. I'm here on behalf of the Montana Dental Hygienists Association. We too stand in support of this particular bill, especially when you can improve access to care into these tribal communities. And with that, Madam Chair, we stand in support. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there further proponents in the room? Seeing none, we'll hear from Byron Larson online.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Good, thank you. My name is Byron Larson. I'm providing the following testimony as the Fort Belknap Indian Communities Indian Health Service appointed Billings Area Community Health Aid Program Technical Advisor to the United States Health and Human Services Indian Health Service Tribal Advisory Group. Sorry for the long introduction. It's pretty technical, and I apologize for that. I want to first thank the Fort Belknap Indian Community Office of the Presidency, Jeffrey Stiffarm, and River Avon District Representative, Tribal Councilman, and Billings Area Community Health Aid Air Certification Board Chairman, and our CHABTAG alternate at the federal level, Dominic Messerly. I also want to thank the Montana State 66th Legislative Session and also the bipartisan support that we received for that bill that actually was signed into law on May 19th, 2019. We are here today in support of extending the sunset date with no modifications to the existing Montana State Community Health Aid Program to September 30th of 2025. Also, a special thanks to the Montana State Tribal Caucus and our House and Senate sponsors, Representative Wendy Boy and Senator Small. And I just want to reiterate that we're executing the requirements under both the statute 1616L as well as the Indian Health Service circular that was produced in 2020. It's called 2006. So I just want to say thank you for the opportunity to support this legislation. Again, thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further proponents online, are there any opponents in the room? Seeing none, are there any informational witnesses? And seeing none, we will hear questions from the committee. And seeing none, Representative, you may close on your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be brief. You know, just like I said, this is extending the program now, and just keep on waiting and fingers crossed that the feds will get off their keisters and get something rolling here for us so we can implement this fully and make it palatable for everybody here. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. This ends the hearing on House Bill 582. Representatives, we will now hear House Bill 509. Representative, would you like to open on your bill?
Madam Chair, members of the House Human Services Committee, my name is Scott Kearns, that is S-C-O-T-K-E-R-N-S. And I have the honor and privilege of serving the great people living on the south side of Great Falls in House District 23. Today, I bring you House Bill 509. This bill revises nonprofit hospital community benefit laws. At its core, House Bill 509 is all about community benefits for all Montanans. In our communities across Montana, there are 47 nonprofit hospitals. These nonprofit hospitals enjoy exemption from paying most local, state, and federal taxes. This is on account of intended community benefit provided by these nonprofit hospitals. Our communities across Montana look to these hospitals for critical services and likewise expect that the tax benefits would be passed on in real and meaningful benefits to impact the health of Montanans. Before I go any further, I'd like to acknowledge the hard work of the Legislative Audit Committee, along with the tireless work of the Legislative Audit staff in their performance audit dated September 2022, which was critical to the development of House Bill 509. I'd want to just say thank you. And thank you to you all. As a starting point, House Bill 509 begins with the fact that currently there is no Montana law regarding overall community benefit spending, but state law requires some Montana hospitals to have charity care policies. The Department of Public Health and Human Services, DPHHS, is tasked with monitoring the charity care law. A key finding of the report is that DPHHS has not developed a process to ensure hospitals provide charity care. House Bill 509 requires that each nonprofit hospital submit a copy of their IRS Form 990 and 990 Schedule H, already required by the federal government to DPHHS each year. This is critical to ensure consistent community benefit reporting by hospitals and to improve the transparency for policymakers and the public. Here, I would note that this is who we're all elected to serve. At this point, Montana nonprofit hospitals measure and self-report on the value of community benefit spending on themselves. Not only do they set the numbers they report to the IRS, they are the only ones to decide if their work has the impact on the health of Montanans. House Bill 509 in Section 1 looks for nonprofit hospitals to provide objectives and key results linked to their charity care and community benefits to ensure that clear impacts on the health of Montanans are achieved. This gets at the legislative audit analysis, which found that community benefit spending has no real clear impact on the priorities identified in the community health needs assessments to benefit Montanans' health. House Bill 509 looks for Montana nonprofit hospitals to provide objectives and key results for Montanans to see the benefits on Montanans' health in their communities. The last big part of House Bill 509 deals with our nonprofit hospitals self-reporting community benefit spending. Within the 8 possible IRS categories on the IRS 990 Schedule H reports, four categories account for 93% based on the 2016 reports. These being subsidized services, Medicaid, charity care, and health professions education. House Bill 509 takes a big rock from each of these four categories that we identify as critical to ensure all Montanans receive real and meaningful community benefits in our state. Okay. House Bill 509, at the end of the day, attempts to take the 2 recommendations of the 2020 legislative audit and implement them. They are simply, and let me just point these to, recommendation 1, the legislature shall enact laws defining expectations regarding detailed reporting of community benefit spending and its impact on community health and the state government entity responsible for actively reviewing community benefit spending. And recommendation 2, charity care review and oversight. The Department of Health and Human Services should define spending and eligibility expectations related to charity care and develop an active oversight and review process that will ensure hospitals have charity care policies consistent with industry standards. It is my hope that throughout this bill hearing today, we can see that House Bill 509 gets at real meaningful benefits for our communities and Montanans that come from our 47 nonprofit hospitals who are being exempt from most state, local, and federal taxes. This bill is all about our communities and the Montanans who live in them. With that, I'd ask for a due pass. Madam Chair, members of the House Human Services Committee, thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Are there proponents in the room? Seeing none, are there opponents in the room?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bob Olson. That's O-L-S-E-N. I'm the interim CEO for the Montana Hospital Association. Madam Chairman, I do have written testimony, just a page with some stuff on it, if I could hand that.
That's fine.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, we stand in opposition to 509 for several reasons, but it's not about lack of transparency or accountability. Our association has adopted policies to basically champion increased reporting, increased transparency, and increased accountability, and we are committed to doing that. We hear a lot about the reporting that hospitals are required to do. They're filing federal income tax forms. That's what the 990 is. It's a complete disclosure of a nonprofit's inner workings. It identifies the board, executive compensation, their financial performance, and it also reports on Schedule H the details of the community benefit reporting. Those are all on that form. Those are public forms. They're available to the public today. So are the charity policies that are adopted by hospitals. They're also posted and available to the public. But if it takes the state of Montana of accumulating that data, then we're willing to share that data with the state of Montana through the Department of Public Health. The whole purpose of the tax exemption and the tax exempt status, the deal that is struck in the tax law, which is what this is about, says that hospitals do the community benefit spending in lieu of paying those taxes. Some of those things that hospitals do would fall on the shoulders of government or other people in the community. So by giving some relief on taxes, they make those expenditures. Being nonprofit also means you're not taking the money off to shareholders or owners. You're keeping those dollars that you might earn on your services to subsidize places where you lose money, but you also retain those dollars in order to perpetuate the mission in your communities over time. Now we have a new deal from the audit. Said, wait a minute, hospitals are measuring it on themselves. This is true. Hospitals do keep their own records, their own books. Those are subject to audit every year when they file their financial statements. The Form 990 and the subsequent Schedule H are audited documents. Those are prepared by the auditors of the hospital and submitted annually to the federal government. And they're submitted like anybody submits their tax statements under penalty of law. If you don't do them well and do them correctly. So I think the characterization that they're just out there doing what they want, that's a bit of a stretch. That's a bit of a stretch in my book anyway. So 509 goes through the process of saying, share those public reports with the government, the state of Montana, Department of Public Health, and we're glad to do that. We will do that. House Bill 45, which you heard before, does the same thing. It says Department of Health will now get into looking at that. The statute that's on the books today is not a policy statute. It's an ingredient to get a license. That's why it's in the licensure statute. What the department has done over the course of time is said, if you're going to get a license, you have to have such a policy, and it has to meet industry norm. So when you got your license and periodic review to keep your license, they looked, do you have a policy? Yep. Does it meet the industry standard? Yep. So you get your license. Now we're going to put additional conditions on the hospitals and on their, which gets us really to the guts of our opposition to the bill, which are on page 12 of the bill. It's in section 5. And the reason that we're not supportive of the bill is because it gets beyond what you're required to do by the federal government. And sure, it puts in here some things that the state wants you to do. But some of them contravene what the federal government requires you to do. So we immediately have a conflict. The federal government instructs us to report things a certain way. The state of Montana comes back and says you can't count things for the state. So that means you're going to have a shadow in your accounting system to account for the things the state wants. In particular, where you get to the financial assistance policies, there's an assumption that it's just all about the income of the patient, and that's not true. Financial assistance policies do look at the income, but they also look at other ways that people can afford their health care before they provide a charitable write-off or a write-down. You can't provide a charitable write-down without a determination of need. That's also in tax law. So what you do is you have the individual fill out an application and determine their financial status, but you also look at liquid assets that they might have. They might not have much in income, but they might have liquid assets that can help them pay their bills. You don't show a lack of ability to pay. There are also policies typical when if someone gets an enormous bill and it just begs credibility that they'll ever be able to pay it, hospitals have policies to write those down to where they're a more credible amount that a family can afford to pay. So financial assistance policy is more complex than what this bill anticipates. Now in the bill it says free care up to 300%, discounted care up to 500% of FPL. That means a family of five, they can get free care, discounted care up to $170,000 of income. Now hospitals typically in Montana, rural communities, small frontier communities, their policies will usually give free care up to 100% of poverty, 150%. They might go discounted up to 50, but their services tend to be less expensive because they are living in the community with limited services. But they also have to consider the income of the community. And when you look at Montana's median income in the mid-60s, House Bill 509 says most Montanans, half, fully half of the households in Montana would be demanded free care at no cost. So it has gone well beyond what current practices in Montana's hospitals. In our larger communities, it's typical for free care at 200, 250% of poverty and discounted care up to 400% of poverty, meaning that different communities face different needs when it comes to charitable care. Last year, hospitals provided $50 million. Thank you. Last year, hospitals provided $50 million in uncompensated care, discounted care under their charity policies, another $50 million subsidizing Medicaid, $186 million subsidizing services. This bill now says fully half of our subsidized services have to be delivered in mental health. Most mental health is not delivered in a hospital, it's delivered in the community by others. When they come to the hospital, maybe our ED will have that much mental health. Maybe. Maybe we'll have a psych unit, we'll have no trouble with it. But we don't know if we can do this. This has never been measured. So part of this opposition to this bill are these standards are unknown, new water, new charted water. I don't know if they're affordable, and I don't know if they're going to meet the statutes. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Are there further opponents in the room? Seeing none, are there any informational witnesses on this bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Carlson. I work for the Legislative Audit Division, and I was the main staff person that worked on this charity care and community benefit audit. And I gave you a summary of the audit last time and my business card, but if you're really dying to talk to me, I'll give you my business card again, if that's all right, Madam Chair.
That's fine. Thank you.
Be happy to answer any questions about the audit.
Are there any further informational witnesses? Seeing none, we'll hear questions from the committee. Representative Nickel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess this would be for the sponsor, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Nickel.
Madam Chair and Representative Kearns. So I have some questions about the community benefits part, as far as if this is a percentage, if it's regulated from hospital to hospital, or if each hospital just gets to pick and choose the percentage of community benefits, as well as what actually are community benefits.
Madam Chair, Representative Nickel, I hope I'm understanding your question. And so I'm just going to turn here in the legislative audit to there's this handy chart, and it talks about on page 14. So this is the percentages self-reported community benefit spending by IRS category in 2016. So the legislative audit took all the reports from all 47 hospitals in Montana and took it for a specific year, because it was the only year that we were able to get at that time. I would sadly say that the statement that these are publicly available forms and that there's no issue in getting them is not correct. When we see this, sometimes there's actually pay windows that are involved, and the closest forms that we could get in 2020 were 2016. And from those, when we got all of the reports, they took all of the numbers and they provided how much percent of each the total is. And so, like, subsidized services made up 45% of all IRS community benefit spending, whereas Medicaid represented 27%, and charity care 15%, and health professions education 6%. Hopefully that answers your question.
Follow-up?
Follow-up?
Okay. Madam Chair and Representative Kearns, I'm specifically the community benefits portion of it is my interest, just as far as one piece of this to kind of bite off. I'm just wondering if each hospital gives the same amount toward community benefits, like on a percentage basis off. They don't. Okay. Thank you.
Asked and answered, Representative Nickel. Okay. Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, Representative, you can go ahead and close on your bill.
Madam Chair, members of the House Human Services Committee, again, I'd like to just thank all the work that was put into this legislative audit. When we talk about and we see oftentimes that there's a discrepancy, when we look at what are the issues and where can we see things can be improved, it's helpful to have dedicated people who are willing to step up and do the hard work of looking into these issues. With that, you know, I would just talk about a few points that were brought up. So, for example, I would point to the statement that we have uncharted water. And just to clarify some of the things that were taken into account when I developed this bill, you know, when we look at the federal poverty level and mentioned in this bill, Oregon recently passed legislation requiring nonprofit hospitals to provide some level of assistance to patients with incomes up to 400% of the federal poverty level. Other states created charity care eligibility floor. In Washington, single patients with a salary between 100% and 200% of the federal poverty level qualify for discounted charges. One state we reviewed, this is not me, but the legislative audit, created a charity care eligibility ceiling. In Georgia, patients making more than 125% of the federal poverty level cannot receive assistance. This isn't uncharted water. These were very deliberate, pinpointed access to four big rocks that make up 93% of what our hospitals report as charity care benefits, and to hopefully very succinctly point to areas where we could improve. For example, when it comes to subsidized services, making sure that those are linked to federal poverty level, Medicaid, that this is that we're actually going to use the cost sheet or not use the cost sheet, but actually what is the actual care of the cost. When it comes to our specific thing with health services, then instead of being able to write off that trip to Tahiti because it's continuing education, oh no, that only those who are directly going to licensure is going to be able to be wrote off. And so that when these hospitals say, will we provide all kinds of benefits to our community, let's see it. Let's see it in real and tangible ways. That's what we're looking for. What we have, and I've gotten numerous reports and numbers from Montana Hospital Association, and we've been going round and round on trying to get the most recent reports from 2021. We couldn't get that. You know, requested another committee. When we tried to actually say, well, what is the aggregate? We got told that no, that's, you know, that's probably too much work. We're not really sure we could do it. Maybe take too much man hours. If this is taking too many man hours for an association that is, by the way, receiving and writing off their community benefit, I believe, in small way, you know, I struggle to make sure that we take care of Montanans. And here in this bill, we're doing small steps to make sure that we have real and meaningful accountability from the legislature and the DPHS is doing their thing to follow up to make sure that what is reported is being reported. You know, one of the things that the legislative audit did say is that the IRS checks for completion on the 990 and Schedule H, but that no one audits this. In fact, they kind of freely admitted that, I guess, in a conversation, and that's found in this book. So when it comes to being able to kind of, I guess, set your own price, say your own things, we find this really, I think, where we need to kind of step in a little bit as the state and make sure that the Montanans are receiving the benefit that kind of has been bargained for by receiving most of their local, state, and federal taxes being written off. So with that, I would ask for a due pass. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the House.
Thank you, Representative. This ends the hearing on House Bill 509.
Open the hearing on House Bill 513.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Jennifer Carlson from House District 69, CARLSON, here with House Bill 513, an act requiring consideration of the harm of removal in child abuse and neglect cases. This bill stems from the knowledge that removing a child from their home can lead to trauma. And we want to make sure that when a child is removed, it is because it is the best thing for that child. It is better than keeping them in their home, and that leads to the title of this bill, considering the harm of removal. We know that long-term, children who are involved in the foster care system have worse outcomes when it comes to education, judicial intervention, mental health, and we want to make sure that whenever a child is removed from their home, it is because remaining in the home is not possible or is not in the best interest of the child. This bill, it does a lot of things, and I will tell you that after this bill was written, you might have remember in your recent history, we've passed quite a few bills in the child welfare system arena. So I do apologize. The microphones are very weird today, so I'll get used to it. When you get to Section 3 of the bill, which is 41-3-427, that section of code has been amended in two different bills, one that has passed the House, one that has passed the Senate. And so the amendments in that section, 423, Section 2 of the bill, that section has been amended a couple of other times. So primarily the changes that we're looking to do are on the first page, making sure that child protective specialists are educated in the trauma that a child can experience on removal. And then looking at the last section of the bill with the changes, I'm just going to go ahead and sit down and let you hear from the proponents and opponents on that, and I will close after you hear what they have to say about those changes. Thank you, Madam Chair. 2 minutes.
Thank you. Could we have who are proponents in the room raise their hand?
Just 2 minutes.
And how many opponents? Okay, we're going to put a timer on 2 minutes. She'll tell you when your minute is up, and then the alarm will go off at 2 minutes. If you could wrap it up, would you appreciate it? Please come to the podium and state your name and spell your last name for us. And if you have any exhibits or written testimony, please pass them to the secretary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Furlong, F-U-R-L-O-N-G. I come here in support of this bill today. Our organization, Montana Child Protection Alliance, advocates for children and families, and oftentimes we come across children that have been removed from their parents and have a lifelong penalty of the separation that has occurred. We often look at the Adverse Childhood Experiences report in reasons for child abuse and neglect. And one of the concerns is we find these kind of abuses that are generational, sometimes even societal norms that happen, and then we respond to those in a way that adds one more trauma to the list of things they're already experiencing. A number of the things that children experience that are adverse situations can be handled through in-home supports and resources in the community, and we're now talking more and more about faith-based resources. We see a lot of children that go into the foster care system and end up acting out behaviorally because the situation they find themselves in is very foreign, and they don't understand, and they don't really necessarily like what's happening, and so they react against it. Those reactions often turn out in residential settings, and we see that kids are going into residential settings and coming out of there to go back to a potential foster home just to end up back and forth into different treatments or different foster families. And these multiple placements that happen to a child really impact their ability to permanently bond with anyone.
That's time. I could wrap it up.
Okay, thank you. And so I've seen kids age out of the foster care system and go right back to their biological families, and we think this bill would reduce the amount of kids that are going back and forth, and hopefully giving them some hope before they have to be removed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Furlong. Any other proponents? We have a Denise Johnson online.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Denise Johnson, J-O-H-N-S-O-N. This bill is intended to ensure that there is a balance between weighing the harm of removing a child against the harm of keeping them in the home. And it is meant to present to a judge so that it becomes part of the evidence to support their decision for removal. In a child's world, to be removed from their parents feels as if they've been kidnapped. Being put in foster care equates to an adult receiving a jail sentence, and children will often ask questions like, why did my parents give me away? And no matter what the answer is, they will feel abandoned by their parents. Once that's happened, a child cannot be unabandoned. And although removing children may seem like a small temporary action, it can permanently damage a child's brain and erode the core of their safety and sense of security. We recognize this as a terribly careful balance about decisions, but making reasonable efforts to keep a family together is required in order to receive federal funds. We, however, do see case after case where reasonable efforts aren't being made, and when I've asked parents what efforts were made, they'll say none. That's not to say they weren't. It's just that they didn't recognize them, or maybe we could have done better. This bill creates a forced pause to make sure that these reasonable efforts are made and that consideration of the harm of removal is weighed prior to removals. It's a part of doing the job well, and then making sure it's documented so that the judge and all parties can be on the same page. CFS, the judiciary, and the parents all recognize what efforts were made. Multiple organizations have studied foster care cases and concluded that children in foster care are 10 times more likely to be abused than children in the care of their biological parents. And that doesn't even take into consideration the over 20,000 children who disappear from the foster care system in the United States every year. Except in extreme cases, there are options to removal. Having a family member or a friend move in with the family, or having a family member who presents a danger leave. Because our state has very high removal rates, we also have high reunification rates. But the best way to make sure our children win is to make sure they don't have to be reunified at all. And if we focus on the strengths of the family and the community to keep the family intact, it costs far less to repair a family situation than the mental health of a child who grows up to be an adult with mental illness. This bill simply puts into writing what already should be happening, especially now that there is access to Family First funds in order to preserve families. Thank you, and I ask for a strong do pass, and thank you to Representative Carlson for sponsoring this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Any other proponents? I do not see any online. We will go to opponents in the room. And we're just telling you when the 2 minutes is up, if we get the courage to do that.
All right, I will try to stick with 2 minutes. Good afternoon, Chair Sheldon Galloway and committee members. I'm Nikki Grossberg, GROSSBRG, Division Administrator for Child and Family Services. I stand in opposition of House Bill 513. First, I want to thank the sponsor for being willing to talk with me about possible amendments. With significant amendments, I may be able to change my position. But currently, the changes to 41-3, 423, page 2 of House Bill 513 contradicts with the changes the House has already passed in House Bill 37, as the sponsor referenced. In addition, the changes to 41-3-427 in this bill are redundant and poorly constructed. The language in House Bill 513 creates a shift that the removal of children from abuse and neglect is more harmful than the abuse and neglect that they currently are experiencing. While we all know removing a child from their parents for a period of time can be traumatizing, it is less harmful than continuing to be abused and neglected at a level that requires removal. I'd like to point out a couple specifics. If you look at page 5, line 24 through 28, we are not able to consider these elements. This is not about child safety. We can only remove children when they are unsafe. If you look at page 6, line 1, we already manage this through our reasonable and prudent parenting standards that are a federal requirement. If you look at page 6, line 3, this is redundant to what's already in 41-3-423. In addition, on page 8, line 13, Child and Family Services is required to follow the requirements of the Adam Walsh Act, which is federal law regarding background checks for eligibility to be a foster or kinship placement. In Montana, misdemeanor burglary is a rule out for placement, though this could be considered a nonviolent crime, which this would put House Bill 513 in conflict with our current background check requirement. There's a current bill, Senate Bill 352, which was being heard this afternoon. I testified on it earlier, that addresses some of these same issues in a way that we were able to support. So I encourage you guys to look at that bill. Basically, House Bill 513 kind of mix and matches petition language with affidavit language, petition requirements with licensing requirements, and is overall just confusing, adding more confusion to Title 41. There are currently 28 bills impacting Title 41, and so would greatly appreciate if there was some consistent approach for what the legislators want Title 41 to look like. I urge a do not pass on House Bill 113. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Grossberg. Next opponent.
Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, Beth Brenneman, B-R-E-N-N-E-M-A-N. I represent the Montana Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. And we have testified on quite a few of the before referenced CPS bills. And I will say it is really confusing to try to figure out what changes what, because there are so many bills that change the same section. We would strongly recommend that you listen to the department about issues especially when you're talking about logistical issues and whether or not they know what they're supposed to be doing from the direction of the law. We have a lot of concerns about how CPS has conducted itself, but we also understand that there are children that need to be protected, and so we want there to be reform, but we want it to be workable, and we don't want the system to collapse. One specific about this bill that wasn't specifically noted just now is Section 3, Subsection 1C2D. Sorry about that, but I had to bring my computer to make sure I was doing the right thing, referencing the right section. But this is about what goes into the petition to the court. And there are a lot of things that go in this petition, and according to House Bill 37, that petition is going to have to go in quickly, and there's a hearing that's going to occur 5 days or 72 days after, depending on what date you choose. And there's a lot of information here that's required to be established that isn't already. The one issue that we have the most heartburn with is D, the child's attitude towards removal. That is a difficult thing to assess. This is usually a crisis, but also having that on the record, whether it's true or not, can really bring about recriminations that are entirely unnecessary. The opinion of the child is not found anywhere else in these sections, and we would ask that that be removed. That is unnecessary and unfair, especially with very small children. They don't necessarily understand the implications of what's happening, and asking their opinion in this sort of crisis situation sets them up for difficulties later. So we would ask that you take that out. Otherwise, the intention of this bill is excellent. We're very much in favor of ensuring that reasonable efforts are made. I have litigated some of these cases, and there is a lot of improvement to be had by the department in identifying the right kinds of reasonable efforts. So the intention of the bill is excellent. That particular issue, that particular section, we would like to have removed, but otherwise, we think it's a very good thing to require more robust, reasonable efforts. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brandenburg. Any other opponents in the room? I have no other people online, so we'll go to informational witnesses. I see none. We'll turn the time over to the committee for questions. Representative Nickel, and then Staffman. Representative Staffman, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for Nikki Grossberg, please.
Ms. Grossberg.
Chair, Representative Nickel.
Madam Chair and Ms. Grossberg, I just have a couple questions, actually, just to kind of clarify some things for myself. So another bill you were looking at was Senate Bill 352.
Is correct. That
the, correct? Okay. And then I'm just wondering why these things would not be put on a list for a judge to consider the child's relationship. I'm looking at Section 3, and then, you know, D could be debatable, but what about E and F and G? I mean, the impact of removal. I'm concerned about these kids. They're getting pulled out of their schooling, their social relationships, and also concerned about distance from of travel for the foster parents should they get pulled. Can you kind of speak to those?
Sure. Chair, Representative. Yeah, so currently we only are removing kids when they're unsafe. So I think it goes a little bit to what you previously heard. If a child does or doesn't want to be removed but is unsafe, we have to take the safety of the child first. Same with their the relationships with their with the people in the home. So the elements that are in this bill, the way it's written, don't allow for safety of the child to be really the predominant reason for removal. It comes if the schooling and those pieces. We already, through our efforts to try to keep kids placed as close to their home as possible so they don't have to change schools. There's federal law that requires us to do that. And we obviously recognize that it's a positive thing for children. We oftentimes don't have an option with foster parents. We're limited in what our options are for foster parents, so oftentimes we're just placing with a foster parent who's willing to take the child and make accommodations to keep the child in their own school. So just because they're placed out of the area does not mean they change schools.
Follow up, please. Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. Ms. Grossberg again. So I'm wondering, I mean, I guess I see these as attempts to make people stop and think just a little bit more before they're making this really big decision to remove a child from their home. I get that safety is an issue, but we also have the highest rate of removal. So I'm just curious as to what else you think maybe we could add in here that...
Chair, Representative, what I would say is that this information is considered in 41.3.4.3 or 4.2.3. So in our efforts to prevent removal, it's not spelled out in the same language. But if you go back to House Bill 37, which you guys have already passed, it talks about the efforts we need to do to prevent removal.
Okay, thank you.
We'll go to Representative Staffman and then to Representative online, Laura Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Grossberg. So I'm trying to understand this bill. On page 5, which is section 3, and this is the petition, and in paragraph B, this petition is only being filed in cases where a child has been abused or neglected. And so we start off with a child who's been abused and neglected, and then it goes on to say, even though the child has been abused or neglected, you still have to show that the risk of staying at home substantially outweighs the harm of removing the child. So if I'm reading this correctly, what it means is there can be children who are abused or neglected, but you're going to leave them in the home anyway, unless you can meet this very high burden of showing that removal is... substantially outweighed by not removing it. Am I understanding that right?
Chair, Representative, yes, you are, and that is our concern with the bill.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome, Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, I have a question for Ms. Grossberg.
Ms. Grossberg, Representative Smith.
Chair, Representative.
Yeah, I just have a quick question just for clarifying purposes. So we... in Judiciary Committee worked really hard on HB 37 and really established some pretty clear parameters for the reasonable efforts. I feel like it's confusing to add another bill on top of that when we really worked hard to clarify it in HB 37, which passed out of the House. Do you have concerns about sort of confusion and clarity if this bill moved forward?
Chair, Representative Smith, yes, I do. In addition, Senate Bill 352 also has language around reasonable efforts.
Thank you.
Do we have any more questions in the room? Millie, could you tell us the process of three bills going through that are similar and how that works in the end for maybe freshmen that may want to know?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, so when a bill reaches its second house, there's something called a coordination instruction added. So as your staffer, when you start hearing Senate bills in this committee, I am running those types of coordination reports and identifying these overlapping sections that, you know, if we had an overhead projector, wouldn't lay on top of one another neatly. But I don't run those reports for House bills being heard here as of yet because we don't add coordination instructions until a bill reaches the second House. Thank you, Madam Chair. I should also say there are specific questions, I could look into this for you. Thank you.
Do any committee members have a question for her right now on that particular thing? Sorry. Yes, because I think
Madam Chair,
you may have some questions.
Sure. Ms. Allen, so none of that takes place until it's gone to the second house, and then you guys will sit down and start to compare lines and so forth?
Madam Chair, Representative Oblander, that is correct, because since a bill has to go to the second house to become law, that's when we start running those reports on a really formal basis and doing really detailed comparisons and then adding those coordination instructions. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Madam Chair, would you like to close on your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the people who testified on this bill. I'm actually in agreement with all of them, and that might sound a little bit odd, but I did have a good conversation with Ms. Grossberg. If this bill is to go forward, I would be asking for an amendment that would completely remove Section 2 of the bill for the aforementioned reason that we have amended it in a Senate bill and in a House bill already, and that doesn't need to be fixed. There is a significant amendment request for Section 3, and I'm inclined to agree after the conversation I had with the department's comments on that. And so if this bill were to be going forward, I would be bringing an amendment. One of the reasons that I agree to the amendment is there are a lot of things that the department is doing that are not in the law but are in policy, and maybe they should be in the law. I don't know. Sometimes we need to be a little bit more nimble as a provider of services to children. So that's why I'm not 100% opposed to the amendment that's been. You don't have it, but I have discussed, and I will get that to the committee. The other thing is there are some things in Section 3 that just aren't feasible. When you are removing a child, when a child is being removed, it's typically not something that you sit down and have a conference about for a long time and get how do you feel about this? Because what we're worried about is, are you safe? But some of these items we do need to know before we remove a child, and some of them, they aren't ascertained until after the situation is made safe. And so all of those things made a lot of sense. I guess the thing I want to also say to the committee is I'm really proud of the work that we've done in child welfare law so far this session. Those of you who are not aware, we will be receiving about 11 bills from the Senate on this topic, as well as the bills that we have passed through House Judiciary. So Ms. Grossberg is 100% correct that we have a lot of moving parts here and a lot going on. I'm proud that we have brought to light a lot of things that need to be, acknowledged in child welfare. And I believe that we're getting there through a lot of these bills. And so I don't want to make it sound like I am giving up on this bill, but I do want to acknowledge that, on account of other bills we've already passed, some of the items in this bill might not be necessary. With all respect to the proponents, we are making good progress on all of these. And I will hope to bring an amendment to the committee to this bill, particularly keeping in the one sentence on the first page where we want our child protection workers to be educated in the trauma of removal. And we want to make sure that before a child is removed, we have made a good faith effort to know that the child is not safer at home. And we've done a lot of that through the work in -423, Section 2 of this bill, which requires good efforts to keep a child in the home before removal. So with all that said, I appreciate the people who are commenting today. And I didn't want to cancel the hearing because I knew we had proponents here. And I think it's important that we make a very thoughtful effort to coordinate our efforts that we've made so far and pass as much of this bill as we can and feel good about eliminated parts that maybe aren't helpful. So thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. This ends the hearing of House Bill 513.
Thank you, members. That was the fastest three-bill hearing that I could have imagined. And we have an opportunity to have a very fast two-bill hearing tomorrow with a list of executive action. So if you have amendments, I don't know if any are still outstanding. I will be having an outstanding amendment to that last bill. So you have a I'm going to let Ms. Allen let us know if she's missing anything for EA tomorrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. If you requested an amendment from me, they have all been entered and through edit. So if you just check out your inbox, there might be something waiting for your approval. And then I will print out another green packet for you folks and bring that tomorrow. But the amendments I will also send out tonight linked online so you can look at them ahead of time. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Millie. Also wanted to let everyone know that if you have a bill to pick up, please pick it up today, like on your way out of here, because we heard from Legislative Services that there are approximately 100 bills to be picked up. And those all need to go to a committee, and executive action needs to be done by next Wednesday on every bill in our packet. And I have a feeling some of those are going to come to this committee. Yeah, general bills have to be done by next Wednesday. So I think that's all we have today. So let's get her done tomorrow. We're adjourned.
Chair, House Bill 45.